Okay, I'm Daniel Costanet. This is a lecture for EC 620 at the University of Tennessee. Other course numbers at our partner universities, but either way, for the current course, I apologize that I couldn't be there in person. I have travel planned for this Wednesday and won't be able to make the lecture. If there are any questions related to the material presented in this presentation, please feel free to email me for anybody at the partner universities or stop by my office for anybody here at UTK. The topic for this evening's talk is electric drive technologies, looking at electric vehicles and the role that power electronics play in them. So I want to begin with a little bit of motivation on why we're looking at electrifying vehicles. So looking at the transportation sector, it is a very significant energy consumer in the United States. Transportation accounts for 28% of all U.S. electricity use. And by moving towards electric vehicles, we have the potential to improve the efficiency associated with that energy consumption. Related to that, it is a big impactor on the environment. 33% of all CO2 emissions in the U.S. are due to transportation petroleum use. That petroleum is somewhat being produced in the U.S., but also being imported. One benefit of moving towards an electrified vehicle fleet is to displace petroleum, displace dependence on foreign oil, improve energy security within the United States, and eventually reduce costs due to some of these benefits once they become widespread in the transportation sector, reducing the total cost associated with transportation. To motivate some of the benefits of electric vehicles, I'm going to use kind of some physics-based analysis to examine the way a vehicle operates. So simple physics one-based equation, I'm looking at a free body diagram of a vehicle. I have a number of forces acting on it. I have the motoring force of the vehicle pushing it forward, increasing its velocity or keeping its velocity steady. Working against that, I have forces like drag, rolling friction, and if I am motoring up a grade, I have some component of gravity working against me. So these are all three forces that are resisting the forward force of the vehicle. Drag here proportional to the square of velocity, depending on the drag coefficient, A, the area of the vehicle, and C, a drag coefficient, which depends on the shape of the body. Down here, rolling friction, we have the coefficient of friction for rolling wheels, which is different than the static or dynamic coefficient of friction. And then we just have the mass of the vehicle times the gravitational constant for what's working against us. This I introduced because it's going to be used in the latter slides looking at the benefit of electric vehicles, also because this is going to be part of the assignment that I give for this lecture, solving out some of this and looking at the benefit of electrifying. So using this physics-based analysis, I can look at what happens when I drive a vehicle over some fixed cycles. So these driving cycles are very common in the assessment of both electric and non-electric vehicles. These are standard. This US 06 driving cycle, shown here in the speed versus time and seconds axes. It's a standard drive cycle that kind of emulates some brief city driving and then a long cruising time on the highway. So you can see in miles per hour, I have some start-stop here at the beginning, and then I get up and cruise somewhere near 60, 70 miles per hour on a highway for an extended period of time, and then drop back down to some additional start-stop type driving here at the end. This total drive cycle is 10 minutes and covers about 8 miles. In order to track this velocity profile, assuming I'm on flat ground, zero grade, I can, using my physics-based analysis, calculate how much power I need to track this profile and move the vehicle through this velocity versus time curve. This is for a roughly Prius-sized vehicle, T taking the coefficients of drag and the mass of the vehicle from a Prius. When I look at the behavior of this power curve, this is the power that would need to be supplied by the vehicle's traction drive in order to drive through this cycle. I notice kind of some expected things that when my velocity is decreasing, I end up with some power less than zero down here. In order to slow this thing down, I'm pulling power out of the system. When my velocity is increasing, I have some positive power, which hits a peak when I'm trying to accelerate very quickly. So if this is not an electric vehicle, this is just some conventional gasoline vehicle, all of this negative power comes from braking action. So I have friction when my brakes clamp on to the rotors of my vehicle. That friction dissipates all this excess energy as heat. So all of the power below zero is lost. It's transferred to heat and radiated from the vehicle. So I can look at over this drive cycle here, my average power used over this entire drive cycle. And for a traditional vehicle, I'll have to compute that just cutting off everything below zero. So everything below zero, I assume that power is lost, and I compute the average of everything greater than zero. If I run that computation for this Prius-sized electric vehicle with normal dissipative braking, I have an average power of 11.3 kilowatts, which I can transfer into an energy use per mile, knowing the average power and the total distance, right about 8 miles. It takes me 235 watt hours per mile in this vehicle on this drive cycle. If, however, I can use regenerative braking, that is, I can pull back all of this negative power, which is possible in an electric vehicle, where I can just operate all of my motoring electronics in reverse and pull energy back from my kinetic energy back into electrical energy. Assuming I can do that with pretty good efficiency, now I can include all of this negative power in my averaging. That'll bring my average down, and I end up with an average power of 7 kilowatts for this entire cycle, or an energy use a little bit more than half as much as I would have in a gasoline vehicle. Okay. So first major benefit of electrifying a vehicle is getting this regenerative braking, and we can reduce the amount of energy use for a given drive cycle. So looking so far, this comparison for a commuter sedan, again, Prius size, but I'm incorporating data from a number of different electric and gasoline vehicles. All of this roughly the same performance and vehicle body type. So regenerative braking, I get that in my electric vehicle. I don't have any way to do that in my traditional gasoline vehicle. My efficiency, which I'll look at in a slide coming up, is much better for the electric vehicle. I can have much higher energy transfer from chemical, either gasoline or battery, to kinetic, actually moving the vehicle. My cost is much lower. Using rough numbers for current prices in the U.S. for dollars per gallon of gasoline or dollars per kilowatt hour for electricity from the grid. So I'm going to reduce my lifetime operating cost of this vehicle by having cheaper energy as my motoring energy. CO2 emissions greatly reduced. Here I'm listing two different CO2 emissions. There's an important distinction here. The first is tailpipe, what actually comes out of the vehicle. For a purely electric vehicle, it's not burning gasoline, there's no CO2 coming out of the tailpipe. So I have zero emissions there versus about 300 grams per mile in a gasoline vehicle. The second is total, which takes into account where did this energy come from. So it's a relatively small difference for a gasoline vehicle. It's about 50 grams per mile of CO2 generated in the infrastructure that produced that gasoline, out in industry where they are refining oil and creating gasoline and then trucking it to the gas station so you can fill up. It's a larger delta for electric vehicles. This largely comes from the more complex manufacturing process for the battery itself, and also from generations in the grid due to current U.S. electricity mix using a lot of fossil fuels and not being completely renewable. So we get about 120 grams of CO2 per mile for the electric vehicle, still significantly lower than what I have in a gasoline vehicle. And then my energy costs, due to this lower price of electricity versus gasoline, I am significantly lower on my energy costs, assuming a 10-year and 15,000 mile per year lifetime of this vehicle. So everything looks grand for the electric vehicle so far. Just to give details on this higher efficiency, the internal combustion engine is fundamentally limited by Carnot cycles. Looking at the physics of it, because it's a heat engine, because it's burning gasoline and creating heat at the same time it's creating force to drive the engine, we're limited to an efficiency of roughly in the 30 to 40% range for theoretical limits for what a internal combustion engine can do. With a electric vehicle, I'm using power electronics and electric machines, there's really no theoretical limit to the maximum efficiency, and practically we can achieve efficiencies in excess of 95%. Another benefit shown on these plots, in an internal combustion engine, we get zero force, zero torque, unless the engine is running, because we're using this four-stroke gasoline engine. We need those cylinders spinning so that they can compress gasoline and then ignite it to provide any torque. Means that we need things like starters, we need things like transmissions to get the behavior out of an internal combustion engine that you want as a driver. It would be a problem if you couldn't provide any force from zero speed. You could never get moving. You'd have to start your car always on a downhill slope. So we include some extra components that increase cost, size, and weight of the vehicle in order to accommodate the characteristics of this internal combustion engine. An electric drive, on the other hand, offers full torque down at zero speed. It's quick off the line, doesn't need a transmission, doesn't need a starter. Right from stop, we can provide the maximum amount of torque. We can do so until we hit a limit on maximum power and then go out to maximum speed. This characteristic of max torque, max power, max speed is much more suited to what we want out of a engine or motor for our vehicle. So we're not limited and we don't need extra components. But it's not all green for the electric vehicle. So there are some issues. Currently, electric vehicle is much more expensive than a comparable gasoline vehicle. And a lot of this has to do with the additional cost of specific components, largely the battery, and to some degree the power electronics incorporated on it. But it's more advanced components, things that we haven't been manufacturing for as long or as well, so it's going to be more expensive. Maintenance, assuming that we have, over the lifetime of the vehicle, one major engine repair in the gasoline vehicle and one battery pack replacement in the electric vehicle. That battery pack replacement, using rough numbers here, anywhere between maybe $7,000 and $40,000 if you're driving a Tesla or some advanced electric vehicle, but significantly more expensive than an engine repair you might expect over the first 10 years of the gasoline vehicle. Batteries are a significant limitation, and they are large and have very low energy density. It results in a shortened range for most electric vehicles, which is limited by the amount of battery I can fit on there and the amount of weight I can handle. The extra weight of that battery causes the weight of my vehicle to be higher than what I get out of a gasoline vehicle in many cases, which then hurts my total vehicle efficiency over its lifetime, because I'm going to require more force to accelerate that vehicle. Energy storage, gasoline, the chemical energy of that I get out when I burn it, very high, almost two orders of magnitude higher than what I get out of current battery technologies. Here I'm going energy per unit weight and energy per unit volume. So for a comparable volume, I'm getting significantly less energy out of the battery. I get maybe three times higher efficiency in use of that energy just due to the electric motor versus internal combustion engine, but I have 100 times less energy available, which is what loops back to why my range is so limited. And then the issue of refueling. Assuming you get about 5 gallons per minute when you are refueling your car at a gas station, taking the energy density of gasoline and plugging it into this 5 gallons per minute, that's 11 megawatts equivalent power when I'm refueling my vehicle. Just a lot of power. We can do better in terms of electrical charging, but better than what we do today, but we're never going to reach that 11 megawatts for recharging a car. Currently, charging of electric vehicles conforms to three different standard levels. Kind of what you'd have in your home would be either level one or maybe level two. If you have a 240 volt AC in your garage, that can go up to 6 kilowatts. Level three fast chargers, the ones Tesla is putting around town in California, go up to 100 kilowatts per the spec, but still, again, a couple orders of magnitude worse than what we can do with a gasoline vehicle. So it means I can't just stop for a couple minutes and refuel and get my full range of the vehicle back. Instead, I need to let this thing charge for hours or overnight once my battery is depleted of charge. So there's issues with consumer acceptability. Looking at where we stand on battery technologies in specific energy and specific power here on my X and Y axes. Currently in these bars, I'm showing the performance of technologies that are roughly commercial, as well as the goal of posed by the government on where we think we need to get in order for adoption of electric vehicles to be widespread, and then some kind of future technologies for batteries and where they're aiming to get. If I want to compare this to gasoline in terms of specific energy of gasoline and specific power that we can get out of current internal combustion engines, I need to reduce this plot significantly. So I can show way up here at 1200 watts per kilogram, what I get for gasoline, and then for a couple different engines, the 2016 Camaro and the Mazda RX-8 with this weird Wankel engine, roughly where their specific power sits. So we're a long ways off. When I look at CO2 emissions, this is a bit of a complex plot, but it shows some very interesting information coming from Argonne National Lab. I'm looking at petroleum use relative to a traditional internal combustion engine, and then emissions relative to the combustion engine. So my ICE vehicle is up here at 1 and 1, so I'm normalizing by its performance. And then these vertical lines, I'm looking at different types of electric vehicles. So this line here would be a pure EV. So it uses zero petroleum. And in the US, assuming the US's current electricity mix, uses about 70% of the greenhouse gases that a internal combustion engine vehicle would use. As I look at different types of plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, so a PHEV40 is a hybrid electric vehicle that has a 40-mile all-electric range. So it's got a battery big enough that I can go 40 miles. After that, it starts burning gasoline. PHEV30, same thing with 30 miles. And then looking at different mixes of greenhouse gases and renewables and how we're generating electricity, I can actually be in some cases worse on my greenhouse gas emissions, better on petroleum in all cases, but depending on which curve I'm on here, which scenario I imagine for how the electricity in the grid is generated, we can actually be generating more greenhouse gases or significantly less. I'm down here on this WECC curve. And between these two curves, we're looking at just how the vehicle is charged, whether it is doing some smart charging that minimizes cost to the consumer or just charging as fast as it can. And policy plays a big impact. So I'm taking a slide here from the plenary session of ECC 2014. What this is doing is it's comparing gasoline price to electricity price, and then these blue curves are targeted prices of batteries. So currently we're somewhere up here close to $600 per kilowatt hour or higher depending on the battery technology. So if I make electricity cheaper and gasoline more expensive, that would be moving this direction on this axis, this direction on this axis, somewhere up here. I only need $600 per kilowatt hour out of my battery for it to make sense to drive an electric vehicle instead of a gasoline vehicle, just as far as the dollars and cents go. So this is where we are. In some countries, it makes a lot more sense. As we move towards where the U.S. is, where we have kept gasoline prices very low and have relatively cheap electricity, I'm needing to get a much better battery technology. $200 per kilowatt hour is still a ways off before it makes fiscal sense just based on price of energy to own an electric vehicle. Even if I have a free battery pack, which I don't see happening in the near future, we still have some limitation for relative costs of gasoline versus electricity price for it to make sense to drive an electric vehicle. So in light of some of these issues, a few years ago, the president issued this EV Everywhere Grand Challenge. He said, looking at a baseline 2012 electric drive system, what we'd like to do is reduce the cost, reduce the size, reduce the weight, increase the efficiency to get towards where it's predicted we need to be in 2022 to expand adoption of electric vehicles. And we're on the pathway to that here in 2016. We've made significant strides as a community in reducing price, weight, cost, and power losses, but we still got a ways to go. So summary, power electronics, how we're actually going to build the backbone of these vehicles are needed in order to expand the adoption of electric vehicles. Battery energy storage is difficult. The technology isn't there and won't be in the near future, so we have to work around that and do the best we can with fully utilizing all the energy available to us. In some studies, up to 33% of the cost of a hybrid electric vehicle is due to power electronics. So reducing the cost and increasing the performance in terms of cost, in terms of weight and volume, and figuring out ways to design around new technologies which are more expensive, but offer higher performance and how to make them cost competitive. So with that, I'm going to jump into the role of power electronics themselves, circuits which process power, are prolific in electric vehicles all over the place, not only in the drivetrain itself, but also in all these auxiliary systems, all the different pumps and drive-by-wire type systems going into modern vehicles. In the presentation today, I'm going to focus largely on the powertrain system, so from the battery to the motor to the wheels, as well as the charger for the battery itself, so some of the more high-power electronics. So a typical EV drivetrain looks something like this. We would have from our battery made up of series connected, either lithium ion or nickel metal hydride cells. We have a battery management system, which is a low voltage cell by cell type of monitoring and occasionally power conversion system that treats these finicky battery cells as gingerly as possible to extend the lifetime of this battery pack because it's so expensive. In some vehicles, most notably vehicles from Toyota, there's a DC-to-DC converter between the battery and the motor drive. The purpose of this DC-to-DC converter is to step up the battery voltage from something on the order of 300 volts to something closer to 600 to 700 volts, the DC bus here. That higher voltage has benefits in terms of increased efficiency of the motor drive and the motor after it, and it also helps to decouple the battery design from the motor design. And so if I don't have this DC to DC converter, I have to build my battery pack to a high enough voltage for whatever performance I need out of the motor. If I put this DC to DC converter in, then I can design the battery to be a good battery, the motor drive to be a good motor drive, and decouple the two systems in my design. And then after that, we have this three-phase DC to AC motor drive inverter that provides three-phase sinusoidal currents through the windings of the motor to provide our motoring action. Okay. And we'll look through a couple examples of designs of some of these systems in later slides. Cooling is also a big issue for a sedan type commuter electric vehicle, we may have 30 kilowatts of power processed through the power electronics, something like a Tesla or a higher performance electric vehicle, we may be up to 100 kilowatts. So even if my system is 99% efficient, I still have a kilowatt of losses. So currently on electric vehicles, we have separate dedicated water cooling systems for the power electronics. So I'm showing here an example of one from Audi Q5. So this is a dedicated loop. It would be nice to use the cooling that's already on your gasoline vehicle. For your internal combustion engine, they typically cool with something like 105 degrees C coolant. And silicon power electronics start to break down around 125 degrees C. So there's not enough room in there to use that engine coolant to keep the silicon power electronics cool. Instead, we have to put in a separate water cooling loop. State of the art, this Audi system that I'm showing here uses 1 kilowatt of power to drive the pumps and fans to cool 4 kilowatts of power losses. So now I get an additional hit on my efficiency of the system because I get kind of a 25% increase in any losses that I generate because of the additional power required to keep those losses, which go from my electronics out to heat, from causing a rise in temperature that destroys my power electronics. So looking at all these things together, the design of power electronics today is kind of a complex optimization process. In the past, power electronics has been largely the pursuit of a reduction in power losses. Today, technologies, devices, topologies are good enough that high efficiency alone isn't enough to surpass the state of the art. So I have to look at many things. I have to look at kind of reliability, limitations here, which is kind of the inverse of functionality, looking at functional integration, volume and weight, the size of this and how that's going to impact the vehicle in terms of reducing space available to the driver, reducing storage space, increasing the size of the vehicle, and reducing efficiency, increasing drag forces and rolling friction, and then cost, how cheap can I make it? So my ideal design on all these is somewhere here in the middle. No losses, it's free, it never fails, does everything you want it to do, and it doesn't weigh anything or have any size. More realistically, we look at different design spaces where we have trade-offs between all of these different parameters, and then based on our application, assess which is the best. So looking throughout the electric vehicle, another view of everything that's on board, from my wall, my AC, I go through a battery charger to my high voltage battery, plugged in when it's charging in my garage or at a fast charger. I have this battery management system for my high voltage battery, which consists of low voltage, low power electronics. Then I go over to my DC to DC converter and motor drive to get to the electric motor and actually provide my tractive force. I also may have this auxiliary DC to DC converter stepping down from this high battery voltage in the 200 to 400 volt range down to my 12 to 14 volt bus, which is traditional from internal combustion engines, where we have this 12 volt lead acid battery, and that goes out and powers all of the low power electronics in your dash, all your drive-by-wire systems. We now like to pull that from the high voltage battery, so I need a very high step down converter. Typical ratings here in the 1 to 4 kilowatts range for total load on the low voltage bus. I'm going to look at here what the internals of one of these power electronics converters look like. And these are images provided by ORNL. Barak Ospinecci out at ORNL helped contribute to this presentation, as well as Dragan Maksimovic from the University of Colorado. So if I look inside one of these power modules, what I start with is a substrate, which is kind of my equivalent of a PCB. This is typically dual bonded copper, which means it's a ceramic with copper on either side. It is going to provide some electrical connections when I put my devices on there, as well as conduct heat out, heat generated in those devices, out to my cooling systems. So on this DBC, I mount my power devices, which are large dies of a single transistor rated for hundreds of amps and maybe thousands of volts. This is a three-phase motor drive. I have six transistors comprising that that system. I attach them on there, both mechanically and thermally, and to make my electrical connections, and typically using wire bonds. All the electrical connections except for the drain are on the top of the device, and I wire bond those out to different kind of isolated portions of copper on my DBC to make my connections. Below the base plate, below the DBC, I have my base plate, which is a thermal conductor used to distribute heat evenly so that I can connect to a eventual heatsink. I encapsulate this whole thing in a silicon gel that insulates, prevents any arcing, and also provides some mechanical support of these wire bonds and keeps the dies from pulling off. And then I coat the whole thing in plastic, again, to provide kind of mechanical support. Then I take this whole thing and I'm going to mount it to a heatsink. If I'm liquid cooled, I have something that looks like this, a big piece of metal with copper tubing with water pumped through it. And I mount my modules. Here I'm showing two of the modules from the previous slides mounted onto this heatsink, and that heat spreader base plate mounts onto the heatsink to get my thermal connection. And on top of that, I would have my interface electronics that are driving the gates of my transistors, doing any local sensing, maybe voltage supplies for those gate drivers, isolation as needed. And then sensors appear sensing voltages and currents that I'm going to feed back in my control. And then bus bars to make all of my electrical connections for these high current and high voltage connections. And finally, a controller mounted on top, typically using a DSP or FPGA type control that's measuring all of these voltages and currents and figuring out how I want to drive my power electronics. I have typically big DC capacitors to contain all of the ripple generated from the switching actions of this converter and from the AC waveforms going out to the motor, and make sure that my DC bus coming in is really DC and I don't have high frequency AC making it outside of the system. So this 3D CAD model is that of a segmented motor drive built out at Oak Ridge National Lab, and here's the real physical prototype from a number of years ago. So that's the power electronics. Now what can we do to improve them? This is a slide again from Oak Ridge looking at what are the problems associated with power electronics, things like efficiency, but not peak efficiency, really focusing on light load. So a vehicle may be rated for 100 kilowatts in the Tesla case, but rarely are you accelerating with full torque at full speed using full power. Most of the time you're kind of cruising and using just a few kilowatts. So the efficiency at peak conditions is important for thermal design, but it's also important at light load because that's the one that's going to determine your energy usage. Higher junction temperature devices, this is one that's going to be addressed by wide band gap, but related to what I spoke about earlier on the cooling systems, how silicon can't run at 105 degrees C for the coolant. Well, maybe new materials can, things like silicon carbide, capable of running at much higher temperature and can eliminate the need for that additional cooling system. Cost is a big issue. We have new devices coming out with better performance using these new materials, but they're expensive, and we need to find a way to, looking at the system level, make it so that that's a net benefit on cost because of the increased performance, because of the reduced size, because of the reduced battery requirements. Research areas, this wide band gap technology, things like silicon carbide and gallium nitride, which I know the power electronics students will be familiar with before everybody else. These are alternatives to traditional silicon electronics. Rather than making our transistors out of silicon, we make them out of these new materials which have favorable characteristics in terms of losses, in terms of temperature operation, in terms of size of the dies themselves. Goals here being to increase efficiency and operate at high temperature. And then a lot of focus on integration. So I can design a very good DC-to-DC converter and I can design a very good motor, but if I can design a topology which is both a DC-to-DC converter and a motor, then I can get some added benefits by reducing redundancy and really this functional integration that I've mentioned. If I can have one converter do two things and replace two converters, well, that one converter can be a little bit more expensive as long as it's net less expensive than the two it replaced, and that's smaller and better performance. And then control algorithms focusing on these light load conditions and also packaging is a big deal. So on this functional integration side, I want to give two examples of research projects. The first is looking at functional integration of a battery charger and a bidirectional converter. And then after that, I'll look at integration of the battery management system into this high voltage to low voltage DC to DC converter, and how using some intelligent design of the power electronics, we can reduce redundancy and end up with a better overall system. So starting with this bidirectional DC to DC and integrating it with the charger, this is a project going on here at UTK. The motivation for it, when I look at the behavior of this DC to DC converter in my drivetrain, this is measurements taken out at Oak Ridge, this benchmarking of competitive technology study where they measured for the Prius, what is the efficiency of the electric drive system, so the motor drive plus the motor itself, at various operating conditions and at various levels of DC bus voltage. So this first curve is 650 volts powering the motor drive. This would be the output voltage of the DC to DC converter. And looking at various speed and torque operations, I've drawn out two different operating points here and highlighted the efficiency of them. So out here at higher speed, higher torque, I'm 92% efficient. Down here, lower speed, lower torque, I'm 86% efficient. Now, if I have this DC to DC converter, my VDC is something I can change by altering the operation of that converter. So if I drop that down to 500 volts, what happens is my efficiencies increase. So at this point here on the left, I've gone up from 86 to 88%. The second point, I've gone up from 92 to 94%. The trade-off here is I have limited operating range. Okay, so by dropping the voltage down, I can't reach as high of a peak torque, as high of a peak power, as high of a peak speed. If I continue dropping down at 225 volts DC bus, about the minimum of my battery pack, I've increased my efficiency all the way from 86 to 93% for this first point. For the second one, I'm no longer able to operate. It's outside of my operating range at this lower voltage. So what I'm demonstrating with this is that there's a benefit to a variable DC bus voltage and looking at how my systems play together. If my DC to DC converter can vary that bus voltage, I can, for any point in the operation range, figure out what is the optimal DC bus voltage that'll optimize the efficiency of my motor drive. Running that analysis, it looks something like this. So speed versus torque, and then my optimal bus voltage. Down here at low power, I want to drop it down to the battery voltage. As I go up towards higher power, either by going high torque or high speed or both, I want to go up to my maximum voltage of, in this case, 700 volts. And then the color of this plot is the efficiency of the electric drive. This has been done to a limited extent in industry. A lot of these DC to DC converters are just fixed voltage, but some of them have implemented a limited variable bus voltage range. But typically when they go fixed voltage or if they have a limited range, they're designing around these points up here at kind of high power operation. So they're looking at bus voltages in the 600 to 650 volt range. And that's great for the high power operation. Like I said earlier, if you're at maximum torque, going maximum speed up a maximum grade, you probably aren't driving very safely, one. But that's not an operating point that you often operate at. So looking at this USO6 driving cycle that I showed early in the lecture, I can look at how frequently do I operate at all these points. And this is kind of a probability density plot of how often I operate at all these different points. You see most of the time I'm kind of in one of these two ranges, either on the highway at relatively higher speed, but low torque because I'm just cruising at a constant velocity, or around town at a constant velocity down at 30 miles per hour, but relatively low torque. Very rarely do I need that full acceleration. So even though points in this range are lower power, you spend more time operating there. So if you can get an increase in efficiency at those points, that will greatly reduce your energy use for driving. So looking at this system, one project that we've worked on is integrating a DC to DC converter with a battery charger. So in a typical two-stage drivetrain topology, what we have, similar to what I've shown earlier, this is a hybrid vehicle now with a motor and an ICE. From my battery, I go through this DC to DC converter and then through my inverter to the motor. And then I have a separate path for charging where I bring power in from the grid, isolate it, go through a power factor correction converter, and then an isolated DC to DC to charge the battery. Down this topic of functional integration, we can combine these two converters, this isolated DC to DC and this non-isolated DC to DC, into one. And the circuit topology behind that is something for another time. But by doing so, we can reuse components and reduce total cost, total size, total weight. These two converters are of widely different power ratings. So my drivetrain DC to DC may be 30 to 100 kilowatts, say 50 kilowatts. My isolated battery charger may be something like 6 kilowatts if it's a level 2. So I'm combining kind of a small power converter with a higher power converter into one. This is ongoing research here at UTK, like I mentioned. What we found when we did this was that even though my charger is much lower power, it's got higher efficiency in this operating region that it can operate in. So that lower power, this was a 1/10 scale prototype, so down below 600 watts and at higher output voltage. This sort of low power and high voltage, which voltage roughly correlates to speed, this sort of operation is kind of down here in the area where we spend a lot of the time operating the vehicle. So I can actually use what was previously my battery charger as my new DC to DC converter, gaining efficiency in the operating region where I spend most of my time. We demonstrated that experimentally. Beyond that, down this kind of thought experiment I've mentioned of operating at higher temperature, working with Oak Ridge National Laboratory, we're looking into high temperature operation of these new materials. So here we're looking at a silicon carbide power module with a silicon carbide gate driver, tested that up to 300 degrees C, looking at combining it into a power module capable of running with that 105 degrees C coolant. And I'll mention more about the shape of this power module a little later. So for my second example, I want to talk about, again, functional integration, but now looking at this battery management system. So what is a battery management system and why do we need it? These high voltage batteries that we use in electric vehicle are made up of series connected cells, often either lithium ion or nickel metal hydride. And the voltage of the individual cell is determined by the chemistry of it. So lithium ion has a voltage range that looks something like this and the 3 to 4 volt range, but due to manufacturing variability, due to lifetime aging, the exact characteristics of each of these individual cells is not going to be identical. Each cell is going to vary slightly, and they're all connected in series. If they were identical, they'd evenly share voltage across them, but as they begin to vary, it becomes a problem. So they have curves versus the total energy stored in them. So here I'm at 100% energy stored. Down here I'm at 0% fully depleted on my battery. Voltage changes slightly over a lot of the range. It's relatively constant. But here I'm just showing three various cells. They all have very slightly different characteristics on this capacity versus voltage curve. And I'm hooking them up in series, maybe up to 100 of them, to build a 300 to 400 volt battery. So they're all going to share the same charging current, which is going to go through this entire string. It's going to be in the direction I've shown when I'm discharging them to power my motor, in the opposite direction when I'm recharging them through my charger. Manufacturers do what they can to limit the mismatch in cells, largely by binning. So most battery manufacturers for electric vehicles will test every individual cell, and then they'll put them in a number of bins for the cells that are most like one another, but there will be minimal mismatch between them when they're integrated into a pack. So why is this a problem? So here I'm going to look at a substring of three cells that all share the same charging or discharging current, because they're all connected directly in series. So these blue bars are going to indicate the state of charge, SOC, of the batteries. And that's typically limited somewhere between about 80 to 90% and 10 to 20% of the total capacity of the battery, because the battery one has these highly sloping voltage curves outside of that range, and two, it'll prematurely age the battery if we have too large of a state of charge swing, go up to 100% or down to 0%. So we typically limit it somewhere in this range. Battery management system would be measuring the current capacity of the battery and limiting it between maybe 20 and 80%. So I'll start with my three cells up at their maximum state of charge, whatever's allowed by my battery management system. And I'll begin driving my car, and all these cells are going to discharge with the same current. And what's going to happen is, because they're slightly mismatched, one cell is going to reach its minimum state of charge before the other two do. And if these cells are just connected in series, that's as far as I go. If I try to pull any more power out of this string, because all the cells are in series, I would over-discharge this cell and reduce its lifetime and degrade the cell. So my battery management system will sense this, and it'll stop me there and say, don't drive any further. It's a problem because I have remaining energy in this pack that I can't access because they're all connected in series. So all this energy is, you know, wasted, not able to be used. The problem gets worse as I go to recharge my pack, because now when I recharge it, that cell that had the most remaining energy and accessible capacity will reach its maximum state of charge first. The other two cells won't be quite fully charged. And if I continue this, now I discharge and charge again. Eventually, I'm going to end up in a state where one cell is at its maximum state of charge, one cell is at its minimum state of charge, and I can't do anything. I can't charge. I can't discharge. My pack is dead. So they don't operate like this in electric vehicles. What they do is they incorporate a balancing circuit. But the typical way that's done is what's called passive dissipative balancing, where I have two resistors and a switch across them, and I turn on this switch to dissipate all that extra energy as heat. I waste all that energy, but that brings my maximum state of charge down, and then I can recharge all cells. It'll still be a little bit different in my state of charges, so I'll do it again. I'll burn more energy and then recharge, and I may do 10 different cycles of this charge and dissipate, charge and dissipate. So a couple problems with this, obviously. One is I'm wasting energy just by burning off the heat. Two is this is extending my charging time, because I can charge the battery up to 90%, but due to this variability, it takes me twice the time to get it from 90 to 100 that it did to take me from 0 to 90. So the problem with this is how it's done in most commercial vehicles. Being a power electronics guy, you of course think Dr. Costanet, wouldn't a better way be to use power electronics? And it would. So I can put DC to DC converters on each of these cells and have them connected to some common bus. Here I'm showing all these DC to DC converters connected up to the full pack voltage. And now I can have kind of bidirectional power flow from each of these cells. And I can take the cells with the most energy and have them provide energy back to the bus. And then from that bus, provide energy back to the cells with the least energy and redistribute all this excess capacity into the other converters. Saving me from dissipating all of that. I'll lose a small portion of it due to the efficiency of these converters, but I'll save the majority of that energy. The other nice thing is this sort of behavior I need to only do when the battery's charging, because I need to charge, dissipate, charge, dissipate. With these DC to DC converters in here, I can do something called active balancing, which is even while my vehicle is running, I can sense the difference in capacity between the different cells and be constantly redistributing energy so that they all hit their minimum state of charge at the same time. They all stay balanced as they charge. I don't have to go through these charge dissipate cycles, charge balance, I instead keep them balanced as they're charging and greatly reduce my charging time. So this has been researched before. It's not common in commercial electric vehicles. The large issue with it is the cost. Instead of a couple of resistors and a transistor, I now need a full DC to DC converter. In a lot of implementations, I need a lot of communication out to each of these per cell converters. And just the wiring harness and the battery to communicate to all of these is a significant contributor to the expense of it. So can we find a way to get this functionality and at the same time supplant some other converter to have this cost issue be mitigated? And that's something I've worked on along with Dr. Zane out at Utah State and Dr. Maximovich at the University of Colorado. So a typical system incorporating out active balancing might look like this, where we use this shared high voltage bus as where we route the energy from cell to cell. Then from this high voltage bus, we have this, I mentioned earlier, 1 to 3 kilowatt high step down converter that goes out to our 12 to 15 volt bus. I said 12 to 14 earlier. With the lead acid battery on it that powers all our low voltage electronics. But why not instead have all of these balancing DC to DCs, instead of sharing the high voltage bus, share the 12 volt bus, and they can all provide out the power that would have been provided by this high step down converter, and then just differentially share how much current they provide. Maybe this one provides a moderate amount, this one a little, this one a lot, to change the stresses on these batteries and have the ones with the most capacity provide more power, the ones with the least provide less, to force them in the balancing. Now I've integrated my nice balancing circuitry for my BMS, saving me energy and charging time. And I've done it with nearly zero cost because I've replaced what was previously its own power electronics converter. So out at Utah State, they're currently in the process of testing this on a full-scale battery pack for the Ford C-Max. It seems to work pretty well. So those are my two examples of functional integration or research topics in electric vehicle power electronics. I want to look at things coming up in the future. The first that I always put into this presentation, but I believe many of you listening to this seminar are innately aware of and perhaps even researching for your graduate work, is vehicle grid interactions. Now that I have this electric vehicle with a large battery on it, a large form of energy storage, that's in my home a lot of the time, connected to the grid, perhaps with renewables on my roof. How can I leverage that energy storage to get beneficial behavior on the grid, either by vehicle-to-grid unidirectional, vehicle-to-grid, kind of intelligent charging, choosing when I charge, or having bidirectional power flow back to the grid? What advantages can I get out of that? Improve the operation of the electric grid. Another one that we're working on here at UTK and that Oak Ridge has made a lot of progress on is wireless charging, allowing the vehicle to be charged without actually having a direct electrical connection to charge that battery. We make use of magnetic coils and coupling between those two through the magnetic fields to transfer energy from the ground up to the bottom of the chassis of the vehicle, and then convert it into current into the battery. There's good things about this. It's safer because the user would not have to ever touch any high voltage, high current equipment. Instead, you just drive over your charging pad and begin charging immediately. It can be autonomous. Issue with electric vehicles is with the limited range. I might only get a full day's operation out of a single charge if I come home and forget to charge my electric vehicle. I'm not going anywhere tomorrow. And then one of the big ones in the future is there are different classes of wireless charging. Static is just at home. I charge my vehicle in my garage. We're moving towards dynamic, which is as I drive over the road, my receiver coil on my vehicle would couple to transmitter coils embedded in the roadway. As I drive over them at speed, I'd have energy transferred up to my vehicle. Sounds out there, but we've had demonstrations on this. It can be done. It's high cost to retrofit roadways. It's a ways off in terms of widespread implementation, but it has a very big upside in that if my power can come from the road and I can be charging my vehicle as I'm driving it, well, then my range isn't limited to my onboard energy storage. And for the same size battery pack, I can go much further, or I can get the range I want out of a much smaller battery pack, because I don't need to have that battery have the energy for my whole 100-mile trip. I need to have it have energy for 20 miles that I might drive in between these dynamic charging segments of the roadway. If I can reduce that battery pack, greatly increase range, reduce cost, reduce size and weight, I get a lot of benefits on the electric vehicle. So looking at these three different stationary charging at home, dynamic charging that I mentioned in these sections of the roadway, perhaps powered by renewables, where I could drive across at speed on a highway and recharge my battery. The in-between is quasi-dynamic charging, which makes a lot of sense for things like buses, which would be kind of stationary charging, but briefly at things like bus stops. This could take my bus, which now needs to run for a few hours and then go refuel, make it so that it can run all day without refueling, because at every stop, it's having energy transferred through this wireless power transfer. For things with known routes, it makes a lot of sense, like a bus. This just shows the demonstrations out at Oak Ridge in collaboration with UTK, both the electrical and the mechanical department, on some of the vehicles we've done there for future vehicle challenges, and then some of their other projects where they've demonstrated actual dynamic charging. And last kind of fun topic I want to mention here is 3D printing and how it's being applied to vehicle design. Here I'm showing out at Oak Ridge some of the 3D printing technologies, this carbon embedded filament that they've been able to print full bodies of vehicles using this extrusion type printer on an XYZ table. It slowly prints out these different body forms out of a carbon material that is comparably strong and lightweight to what we make vehicles out of today. This vehicle was in collaboration with Local Motors. They're actually looking to commercialize the world's first 3D printed electric vehicle. The Shelby Cobra you might have seen was recently printed by Oak Ridge. We had a maybe hard to see here, President Obama, Vice President Biden come out and sign that vehicle. What I found very funny was this vehicle looked like this about a week before the president came. It was these built up layers, very rigid, very rough. And somebody out at Oak Ridge, I don't know who, spent the whole week sanding this thing and applying Bondo and painting and sanding to get it to look nice before the president came. But very exciting to see. I think there will be a lot of applications of 3D printing to power electronics, and that we're looking into is this called the compact inverter. This compact module design I showed earlier when I was talking about the DC to DC and the high temperature operation, these end caps are 3D printed out of aluminum. They have electrical bus routing and connections for the interface board, as well as mechanical structure and cooling channels all integrated into them, which is a complex geometry that we can do with 3D printing. And it allows us to reduce the size of the inverter by integrating a lot of different functionality into one, in this case, electrical, mechanical, and thermal. So, wrap up there. Conclusion, power electronics are critical to where we're gonna go with electric vehicles. In order to continue advancing the field, the power electronics engineer has to think about the complete system, look at opportunities for saving costs by functional integration, by using new technologies. And some of these future technologies could revolutionize the way we adopt electric vehicles. So I apologize again for not being able to be there in person. If you have any questions, please email me. It's my email for those of you that don't know. If you're on campus, stop by and see me at MK502. I'd be happy to talk to you about anything in this presentation or any other topics related to power electronics or otherwise. Thank you. Enjoy the evening.